Hello there, and welcome to the latest edition of the DF Direct Q&A show. Lots to get through this week. Joining me, first of all, hello, John Linneman.
Hey, Rich, you have your video off in Discord, so I can't comment on your background.
Which is a boon for our audio podcast listeners. Also joining us, Oliver McKenzie.
Yes, I'm sure John is very miffed by that. I am personally not too bothered. You empathize with those poor podcast listeners bereft of the video feed.
Okay, I guess we should just crack on with the questions. Okay, so we're going to kick off with this question from Taylor Wiseman. Hello, DF crew. I own a Nintendo Switch 2, and I loved playing Call of Duty with friends back in the day, but I'm cautious about getting the Switch 2 version of Call of Duty Modern Warfare 4. This is because I am unsure if it will run well, given that it's not as powerful as the current Xbox or PlayStation. I know the Switch 2 port of Resident Evil Requiem held up very well, but I'm still not sure if Modern Warfare 4 can run similarly well. What do you think? Thanks, and keep up the good work. Great work, even. Oliver, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because ultimately, this is about scalability. It's about strategic nips and tucks in order to get an experience that still works on less capable hardware. I guess the engine that we know of its sort of capabilities has been built to scale across generations in the past. There's no PlayStation 4 or Xbox One version this time. Switch 2, we'd expect better results than those last generation consoles. So, I'm kind of thinking more of sort of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth here, where it was still recognizably right. The same game, but it was obviously cut back.
Yeah, it could very well be. I mean, I guess it depends on what kind of technological improvements they're cooking for the new Call of Duty title. I know they mentioned a few things, like a wider scope. On the PC side, they're talking about enhanced ray tracing features, including ray traced reflection, shadows, ambient occlusion, and I think volumetric effects as well, which is pretty tantalizing. But I presume none of those would be on Switch 2, and I would also think probably they're not going to be on the consoles, maybe on PS5 Pro. I mean, maybe on the PS5 or something, Series X, who knows, but maybe not in the consoles either. So if that's true, and if they're scaling up the game's visuals primarily by targeting ray tracing, I mean, it does not really feel to me like a game that could not be, PS4 class visuals on a Switch 2 fairly easily. It just depends on that scalability they're building into this title. But you'd assume that given that they're targeting Switch 2 for a long period of Call of Duty titles, I think, many years of Call of Duty titles, as was planned, as was announced, I think they probably are going to have a reasonably good, reasonably scalable version of the game on Switch 2. I think the other major question here is just, what kind of frame rate are they targeting? Are they going to try to hit 60 FPS? Because we know that 60 FPS was the target on PS4, was not always met on PS4 or Xbox One last generation consoles. Past Black Ops Cold War, perhaps Vanguard, things got a little bit shaky on those consoles, I would say. So depends, are they targeting 60? Are they targeting 30? Are they going to do a 40 FPS mode? That's all up in the air. But, Switch 2 does have some advantages relative to those consoles. Like, it has fast storage. It has DLSS, which is a major boon. It has the file decompression engine. It doesn't feel that crazy to me, looking at the footage that they've published, that there could be a good version of the game on Switch 2. Just depends on how they've set things up and how fully next gen they're going with the rendering systems, right? That kind of remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. John, what do you think? I mean, I think from the graphic side of things, there's probably a lot of stuff they can do in order to get a good frame rate and to pare back the game. But on the CPU side, I'm curious about what they can do there. I guess the other thing, thinking back historically, multiplayer tends to run better than campaign. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, they've been shipping Call of Duty on Xbox One for years now, right? I feel like yeah. More so than most, these guys are really well suited to work on lower power devices because they've been doing it forever, right? So even if there are some improvements made to the underlying tech here, Infinity Ward is often the one to do it, and it does look good, I admit. I think it should still remain relatively scalable. I guess the question is whether they will prioritize fluid performance or fancy visuals, right? Because in the past, Call of Duty, it is always aimed for 60 frames per second, but there was a period, I'd say, the latter half of the PS360 generation where 60 was more suggestive in single player, and they largely didn't always get there. But then that kind of course corrected itself as we went into the current, or I guess the last generation. And I guess we'll see. Will they just settle for, say, fancier visuals in the campaign with more dips, but still going for like a stable 60 in multiplayer? It's hard to say. In addition, you know, we have to remember that they've continued to support 120 frames per second, I believe. Yep. Like, even if it wasn't completely stable on the current generation, the bigger consoles, right? So I just feel like all signs, based on the way it's been performing and how many platforms they've shipped on, point to it being, you know, a pretty good port. So I'm fairly confident it'll be fine. I would hope it runs better than Resident Evil Requiem, because while Requiem did hold up very well and we were impressed with it, the frame rate is definitely not a stable 60, right? And I think 60 would be more preferable here. I maintain that the biggest concern with Call of Duty is if you decide to play in portable mode. I just don't think Call of Duty is a great portable game. But beyond that, like, I think it'll be fine.
What do you mean by not a great portable game?
Because, as I mentioned on Direct, like, in these games, you are largely shooting small targets at a distance using scopes, right?
Okay.
And yep. That I found personally, like, those types of games just don't play that great on a smaller screen because the targets are just quite small, and it just feels less pleasant to look at than something like, say, I was gonna say Doom, I guess, a modern Doom, but those are pretty fast. Like, you need to. Portable play is tricky for shooters, I'll just say that much. And Call of Duty is probably one of the trickier, especially if you get into multiplayer, where I feel like you're just not going to stand much of a chance. Like, trying to play with the Joy-Con against people on a smaller screen, that's like setting yourself up for getting beat. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you got a mouse, John. I suppose that doesn't really make sense in the portable side of things, tabletop.
Yeah, you could, I guess, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, John, in Black Ops 2 for Wii U, I had a pretty fashionable kill-death ratio on there. I was like 1.3 KD, 1.4 KD, and I was playing primarily on the game.
You played on the gamepad?
I did.
All right.
But,
well, that's impressive.
But I will say that was against the Wii U gaming community, which perhaps was not quite as sharp as the...
How many of the others are also on the gamepad?
I would also, I guess those games back then were mostly designed for like 720p and even scaling down to 480p of that display. Like, things were a bit chunkier, right? And I think we just have finer detail in a modern Call of Duty game where everything is just super crisp and small. So we'll see. I don't know. I could just be old and I'm looking at it like, oh, it's too small.
Yeah, I get what you're saying from that perspective. I think on the marketing side, the question is, how much are we going to see of this Switch 2 version and when? Because, you know, I think this is really, really exciting. You know, a brand new platform for Call of Duty. Assuming the software is good, I'd be showing it as soon as possible and getting people hyped up and excited for it. So I'm curious as to whether that's actually going to happen. And if it doesn't, you know, if it's one of these situations where we don't see much of the game until, going up to launch, then I'd be slightly worried.
I want to see this on Nintendo Direct, where they have like the soft voice narrator, like murder your foes and this year's Call of Duty Modern Warfare 4. You know, the North Koreans are out to kill you. Are you gonna take that? You know, kind of just like, it's like, team up with your friends and kill them together.
Yes. Shoot them in the face.
Yeah. And all the footage in Nintendo's remit here, you know, you're always missing them, right?
Yeah, exactly. They'll miss everyone.
Indie footage. Yes, you're missing every single shot. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so don't shoot them in the face. Avoid shooting them in the face based on this footage. Okay. I still think it's all about the marketing, right? I really want to see this and, you know, brand new platform for Call of Duty. Let's see it. And if we don't, as I said.
Yeah, but Rich, they can't show the logo now. That's the thing, right? They can only show the Xbox logo.
So. Oh, dear. We aren't going to go into the logo discussion, are we? I just don't want to go there.
Let's stop here.
Yes. Okay, let's move on to the next question. some guy person asks, by the time you read this, the NVIDIA N1X will have been announced. I feel it doesn't make much sense, and I feel it will be way more expensive than the internet at large believes. Do you feel it won't do very well, like Ian Cutfass and myself believe? Well, Ian Cutfass is a renowned tech analyst. And I watched his video this morning, 32 minutes of basically saying this is, I don't understand why NVIDIA made this device. Oliver, do you understand why NVIDIA has made this device? I mean, I think we should say that this question is arriving post Computex announce, where it was basically revealed that the RTX Spark, as it's known, yes, it can play games. Yes, it's using Windows on ARM. And Jensen seemed basically more inclined to talk about its use to power AI agents, which, I guess we're going to find out much more about that in due course. But yeah, there is some merit to that. But the gaming side of things, it's going to be quite interesting to see just what it can and can't achieve. What do you think?
Well, I certainly think on the AI front, as maligned as it might be, there are some interesting elements to this device, namely that it is an NVIDIA processor, a fast NVIDIA processor. It is in a consumer device. I mean, maybe a prosumer device, arguably, but, consumer level device, basically. And it has 120 gigabytes of memory, which is a lot. And that's pretty good for big models, big LLMs, throw a ton of stuff on there. That's the key limitation of consumer graphics hardware, that, you get 16 gigs if you're lucky, 32 if you shell out a ton of money. It's not enough really for these models, even though the hardware could be very powerful. It's just not enough memory. So having that amount of memory, very, very cool. But I think this is something more like the DGX Spark, where it's more for maybe specific users. I'm a little bit nervous about the state of Windows on ARM. I know they talked about compatibility for all the top titles, and they're going to have some anti-cheat compatibility as well, which is good, but I don't have a whole... My confidence is not really there. I really want to see the proof in the pudding on that one before I make any kind of pronouncements. And then just in general, Windows on ARM, I don't know. It people say it's pretty good, but I also read a lot of horror stories about I can't run Premiere on it, or I can't do this, I can't do that. Like pretty fundamental things that you want to run on a computer like this if you work professional of some kind. But outside of that, I think it's probably an alternative to a MacBook Pro. It'll probably fit into similar kinds of systems, similar kind of chassis, offer similar kinds of performance. Although I've seen some benchmarks that, it's a little bit slower than like an M3 Max in some respects in terms of CPU performance, at least. In GPU performance, I think it will be more competitive. But obviously the CPU IP they have in here is a little bit older and not quite as fresh as some of Apple's latest. So I think it's going to be a pretty cool product, but for a specific kind of user. And I think you see that in the branding, because I think the device that's been announced alongside the N1X or the RTX Spark is the Surface Book Ultra, something like that. The new Ultra Windows Surface laptop, and it's being positioned as like a really high-end product. So I don't think, I think for most users who don't care about this AI stuff and maybe wouldn't mind a computer that's a little bit thicker, will probably get pretty substantially similar performance out of like a gaming laptop for, $1,500 or something, $1,600 with an RTX 5070 laptop GPU and a decent AMD or NVIDIA or Intel processor, and they'll probably have better compatibility with the popular apps and games that they want to use in the device as well, right? So I think it is probably a niche device, as Ian Cutress indicates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was also reservations about the CPU side of things, because essentially the whole thing is a collaboration with MediaTek, and it's using basically MediaTek CPUs. And obviously NVIDIA has moved on with its actual workstation stuff. It's got its own CPUs, which are considerably better than what's in here. From a gameplay perspective, from gaming rather, my take on it is pretty straightforward. I'm not expecting great things from it from a CPU perspective. I'm ready to be proven wrong. I'm not expecting, amazing performance for gaming on the CPU side, but the GPU looks very, very interesting. And the question is the extent to which you'll need to rebalance your games, because, the CPU is kind of like a hard limit. There's not much you can do with it. But if you are CPU limited, that leaves a lot more GPU cycles available to do more on graphics, higher resolution, more effects, ray tracing, that kind of thing. Very curious to see what it can actually do. I don't see it as a kind of mainstream device, as you pointed out there, Oliver. You know, it's going to cost thousands. I mean, if you see the size of the chip, it's gigantic. It's like a, it's a, you know, it is a 5070 Blackwell GPU die kind of fused with NVLink to the CPU setup. So, you know, it's going to be expensive. So I suspect it's going to be like a fringe device, mostly for people who want to run CUDA on a laptop for whatever reason. I think, wasn't Jensen showing like desktop variants as well?
I think there will be like mini PC versions of this as well, which is quite similar to the DGX Spark, but I presume with like Windows licenses and driver support and all that good stuff you'd want, right?
I think it's time to take another look at Windows on ARM just generally, because when I first tried it on the Surface with the Snapdragon, it was awful with terrible stutter. I do expect better from NVIDIA. So very curious about that. And I guess, you know, if they can get this right, I mean, Ian was wondering why they're releasing it at all. And I think from my perspective, it's pretty straightforward. A first generation device, an outlier device that basically sets the groundwork for getting Windows running on ARM with an NVIDIA GPU and, you know, a proving ground, so to speak. And then in the future, if it takes off, if there is a demand for this sort of stuff, then NVIDIA can move into the integrated graphics space for gaming and, you know, cheaper devices, smaller dies, that sort of thing. I think it could be quite good. But in the meantime, it is kind of, from what I can suspect, you know, a much more niche device, not for the mainstream. John, you were tweeting this with some trepidation before it actually was announced.
Sure. I mean, they announced that the PC system, what was it specifically? It was like a new era of PC from NVIDIA and Microsoft. I mean, that's almost ominous to me. Like, it's like, really? But they've continued to claim that this is a new beginning for personal computers. They have reinvented Windows PCs. Based on all the information out there, can you explain to me how they've reinvented Windows?
Oliver, do you want to take this? It is basically about agents, isn't it?
Well, it's about, I mean, I don't believe this, but it wouldn't be about AI agents. I mean, the problem at the moment is that most of the AI agents that you'd want to run would probably be running in a cloud somewhere. But, you know, as these models develop and as people distill them down into more and more powerful models, I mean, you can run a pretty cool model locally. I don't know if you'd want it to take, like, the idea of an agent that takes over the basic UI navigation on a computer, certainly you can do this, but I think the use cases for it right now are limited in an environment where there's still a fairly high error rate, and maybe a navigating UI isn't the thing you want an AI agent necessarily to do. Maybe they would be better navigating the internet with plain text and things like this. I don't know. There are all kinds of arguments and all kinds of things you could do there, but for sure, this would be, I mean, it's a good computer, I'm sure, for AI agents, that it can do a lot of things that, like, a 5090 can't, because the 5090 with 32 gigabytes of VRAM can't load in a very good, very large LLM, for instance. Well, sure, this certainly can.
I'm just arguing over this idea that this is they have reinvented Windows, and I'm completely, like, what you're saying is not reinventing Windows. There's
you're quite right, John.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, the pitch at Computex was basically, yeah, all of this stuff is going to happen and you can do it on this device, but it hasn't happened really. That's the thing. And Windows itself hasn't really changed. It's Windows. You know, you're going to load it up, you're going to be seeing the same login screen, you're going to be doing the same things on it in the short term. I don't see it being any kind of reinvention in that respect at all.
That's just the disconnect I see, especially with all these AI agent stuff they keep shoving down people's throats, is it just feels like nothing's really changed that much in terms of what the user actually does. And all that stuff is still largely not trustworthy, especially with certain larger projects. Like, I know people that have been basically within companies where they're being asked to use this kind of stuff for things. And it's become a huge problem, especially for my sister that works in the legal field. They've had to dip into this AI stuff. It's become like required in some instances, and the amount of errors, mistakes, misreporting and stuff, the cruft they have to go through for this, makes it virtually unusable, because you just cannot rely on any of this stuff to actually return a usable result. And there's just that this applies to so many other fields. plus the whole nature of like turning your PC into something where an AI agent does everything for you is largely unappealing, I think, to most users. And the fact that none of this even seems to be existing yet here. It's just a bold claim to come in and say, yep, we're reinventing Windows, and then this is what they're offering. Like, that is stupid to me. I don't like that. But I will say, conversely, I do think it's cool that NVIDIA is getting it, you know, pushing more ARM-based hardware here, and this might lead to improvements on, for Windows on ARM, which I would say the first round of that was rather poor. It's not something I would have enjoyed using, and I think Apple continues to run circles around Microsoft in that space with their the Apple Silicon, which is just incredibly powerful and very efficient. As I'm sure Oliver and I can agree on this, that Apple's really doing great work there, and Microsoft hasn't had a partner that can actually compete anywhere close to that. NVIDIA is one partner that could potentially actually get there, even if it's not right out of the gate. But, you know, there's actually a lot of room to grow here, and I do think moving towards ARM is not a bad thing. There is definitely some long-term compatibility issues to contend with, but it's very promising stuff. So there's like good and bad to come out of this for me. It's not all bad, mind you. It's just this whole, I just couldn't help but laugh at this idea that they've completely reinvented PCs again. And it's just not, it's so far from being accurate to anything that I'm just like, okay, you guys are just spitting nonsense again. Stop yapping.
Well, I'm not sure anybody's like reinvented the computer. I guess Apple got close with Apple Silicon, you know, but it was still fundamentally doing the same things, right? It was just a, mm-hmm. a radical overhaul in hardware design.
I guess, Rich, do you want somebody to completely reinvent the PC? I like what computers have become, and I think they're pretty awesome. And taking
well, nobody
it,
nobody like said the, what it is, you know, what well, reinvented
all of what? The. All of the suggestions about reinventing personal computers revolves around taking things away from you. It's like, oh, you don't have to do that thing anymore. We're going to have the AI do it for you. And that never sounds appealing to me. I mean, I guess there's some people that hate using computers and they'd rather just like use it. But it just, it's different, but it reminds me of that era where they were obsessed with making everything voice driven. Like, oh, you can just talk to your computer and it does stuff for you. Everybody hated that. Or, oh, now you can use a pen on your computer and you can just handwrite your stuff. It's like all these like attempts at naturalizing input and interaction with your PC, they always fall flat on their face or they're just not enjoyable to use. I think AI is probably more capable than any of that stuff, but it's just, it has shades of it that I'm just like eye rolling thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think we can safely say the PC has not been reinvented with the release of the RTX Spark.
It has not been reinvented yet, I'm afraid.
It's going to run Windows. And, you can play games on it. You can run things on it. It allows you to run tools. The quality of those tools will vary on a case-by-case basis. There's not really any kind of reinvention here. But, you know, it's all hype, isn't it? There's everybody hypes their stuff.
Of course.
But ultimately, you know, I'm still going to be looking at a Windows desktop at the end of the day.
And if you want, also, you know, if you want a similar experience now, I mean, there's Strix Halo. There's if you get Panther Lake with 120 gigs. These are fast processors as well. They can do, I mean, they're not as fast as an RTX Spark, but they're plenty fast and they have plenty of memory. And at least as far as you can get like cross-vendor AI workloads running on them, they can give you some of the same functionality if you don't want to go to the cloud. So I don't think this is necessarily all that new on PCs either to the point about reinventing the PC. I actually think arguably it's already been reinvented, at least if you look at it from that perspective, right?
Oh, man. Marketing 101, gents.
Well, you know, I think, yeah. There is a lot of big integrated GPUs out there now, which is fundamentally what this is. I think from my perspective, the exciting thing is probably going to be when the NVIDIA GPU is packaged with the Intel Core CPUs, that deal that was announced, I think, last year. From a gaming perspective, I think that's going to be a lot more exciting than this. But, you know, I'd like to take a look at the RTX and see what it can do.
The hardware seems good.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on. Question here from Corey Myers. Hello, everyone! Exclamation point. With the price increase of the Steam Deck, I don't think this will bode well for the upcoming Steam machine. I was looking at getting a Steam machine for my son to enjoy our Steam library, but now building a PC together seems like a better slash cheaper option. Would love to see a future video of a price-matched custom-built PC versus the upcoming Steam machine. Keep up the excellent work. Yeah, I mean, well, I think the thing is, we don't know how much the Steam machine is going to be. Obviously, we're not hugely optimistic based on the Steam Deck pricing, right? So the question then is, you know, will this have an impact on Steam machine pricing? Quite possibly. Everything is having, you know, this whole sort of hardware crunch at the moment has had an impact on pricing. What I will say, though, is that if we look at the components of the Steam machine, it is fundamentally what I would describe as a, you know, an entry-level mainstream gaming CPU and GPU. So I think you probably still could build one of those relatively cheaply. 8 gigabyte GPUs haven't seen like gigantic price rises. So if you wanted like an equivalent RX 7600, I don't think that would be hugely expensive. Or if you wanted an NVIDIA 5060, I don't think that's been massively expensive. AM4 platforms with DDR4 memory, you can save money there. I'm going to be very, very interested to see how you can build, you know, how expensive it would be to build an equivalent PC. But there is this, you know, this massive caveat, which is simply this. It's a self-contained small form factor machine that's had a great deal of hardware engineering put into its physical form factor, its thermals, that kind of thing. So, yes, you could probably build a PC that would probably be cheaper. We don't, you know, we don't know yet because we don't know how much the Steam machine is going to be, but, you know, possibly. And it would be somewhat larger, I think. Have I missed anything there, Oliver?
No, I don't think you've missed anything. I think the chief appeal of the Steam machine is the fact that it's an all-in-one box that runs SteamOS, looks beautiful, seems to run very well. Certainly I saw that in person when I looked at it back in October of last year. But in general, you can probably get something that's of a comparable price, I'd assume, on the DIY market or the pre-built market, because Valve said so themselves. They said we're pricing it similar to a pre-built, so I would expect it to be a similar price. In terms of that DIY option, though, I do think that if you're not married to the idea of building it yourself, I know that's important to a lot of PC users, including Alex, including other people, then buying a pre-built would probably be cheaper if you're just looking for new components. Which, I mean, a pre-built with a 5060 right now on Newegg in the United States is about $1,000, up from about $800 a few months ago, but still $1,000 is about the ballpark I'd expect the Steam machine to be in as well. I mean, maybe even higher than that, who knows at this point? Like, it'll be a high price probably relative to expectations even rather recently. But yeah, I would expect that DIY or pre-built, reasonable, if all you want is price and performance and upgradability, for sure go that route. But if you want something cute and console-like and running SteamOS natively and all this good stuff, then, you know, the Steam machine seems like a good buy if it comes in at a price that's remotely reasonable. But the definition of reasonable is changing every day here, Rich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. John, I was reading this question. I was thinking about you and your son. And when you we talked about it in the last Direct, I think, about building the PC. That's actually quite an interesting experience. I think it's a good way to teach the younger generation about PCs.
I agree. I was going to suggest that as well, that, yeah, the Steam machine is one option. But in this case, I genuinely think he would probably have a good time building a PC with his son. Having, like I said, having just done that a year or two ago, it's extremely rewarding. And they do learn a lot, you know, because it's, they have to go through the whole process from putting the components together to actually getting Windows installed and all of that. I mean, it's trivial for us, but like, you know, somebody that's never done it before, it's cool. And it helps give an appreciation for how it all comes together, I think. And so he's very much aware now of like the pieces in his PC, the hardware that he's running, and takes care of it a lot as well. So it's, I do think building and maintaining a PC is a good experience for someone, a younger kid, basically. It's a cool thing to do. If they have interest. I mean, if they don't. Yeah, and upgrading as well. Exactly. Upgrades are fun. It's exciting. I know I inadvertently got my son addicted to higher frame rates. He likes basically, like, I think I've mentioned it before, but he runs like a 165 hertz monitor, I think. But there was this one time where he came down and he's like, "Dad, my computer's broken. There's something going on." And I could come and he's like, "Yeah, it's so laggy." And he's like moving the mouse around. And I realized he had just set the monitor to 60 hertz by accident. And then we put it back up to 165. And he's like, "Oh, okay, it's good now." And it's just, he does not like, and he's in games, like he has his FPS counter on. And he's like, you know, when it's 60, he's like, "Oh, that's rubbish. It's trash." Wow. Like he doesn't like 60. He thinks it feels bad. He's like, "It's so laggy."
What? So has he been introduced to the concept of frame generation?
Not yet. Okay. But
that's going to be an interesting experience for him. It's kind of like going to be how it feels versus how it looks.
Yeah, for him, he is more about the feel for sure. And he plays shooters, and he's like, he destroys me at them now. And I've seen him play on that mouse, and it's just like, oh yeah, he's pretty insane to watch. So is very acutely aware of these frame rate differences. And he does have exposure to CRTs. He doesn't really care though, but he's definitely can see the difference, but he's like, whatever. So
man, is that a parenting failure?
Possibly, yeah.
Okay, let's move on. Got a question here from Real Frame Collector. Good morning, folk. Hope you're ready to forge some great coverage to your usual high standards. Tying back to your discussion on First Light's review code, it seems that in general, game review embargo conditions are becoming more restrictive, and the outlets / personalities that review copies go out to are chosen more selectively by publishers. What's your experience of this trend, and what's the oddest review restriction you've come across over the years? John, do you agree with this idea that the people actually receiving code is has changed in some way? I'm not sure I do.
I don't feel like that's actually the case at all. I think there's just probably a few high profile scenarios where things were weird, but like there's always been that, right? I mean, at least since I've been doing this since 2013, we always, at least, you know, a couple times a year, bump into a situation where we're waiting for something, and for some reason or the other, it's either difficult to get, or it's like there's weird restrictions, and that's just kind of how it's always been, right? And I can't really say that's a big deal. I mean, I guess some of the embargo stuff, like limiting, like, oh, you can't talk about the hardware comparison stuff yet until like after review embargo, or like placing huge restrictions on like you can only show 10 minutes of footage, stuff like that sucks, but it doesn't actually help them, I would say. But it's again relatively uncommon. The biggest issue really comes that we've had lately really comes down to that whitelisting system we talked about on Xbox, which I think is actually not a good thing for them, as we noted. So, but yeah, it's about the same.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been doing this since like 1990, right? So like, I'm sure it's changed a bunch, especially in the shift to digital, but I mean, you have a lot of experience with embargo stuff, right?
Yeah. It is kind of crazy. I'd say the situation's probably better than it was in, like, you know, turn of the century, you know, early 2000s, because it was driven by magazines, and magazines would secure exclusive review, right? And that basically locks out everybody else from reviewing until your review is out. That doesn't really happen anymore. So in that respect, it's kind of less restrictive. And I think that's, you know, obviously a lot better, because when a review comes out, you want to see a diversity of opinion. And I think by and large, you get that, right? We obviously are slightly different to a mainstream outlet. There are probably reasons why people don't want to give us review code. Going back, I guess the most notable one, I think, back in the day was Hogwarts Legacy, where they wanted us to review the day one experience. I can kind of understand that kind of thing, where it's, I think, yeah, and this was a policy also for another company. I won't go into the details there, where they basically said, yeah, you can review it. We'll give you code, but we want to make sure that you're reviewing the day one experience. I think if I'm a technical outlet-based scenario, that might make sense.
I think so.
It's slightly annoying, though, that they don't give you the code beforehand because, you know, we waste a lot of time getting to know the game, which we could have done earlier. There's also sort of a lot of games companies where we're not on their primary distribution lists and we have to kind of chase for code, which is a bit frustrating when other people just receive it. That's kind of something else that's going on there. I'm not really seeing sort of onerous changes to the reviewing process, though. I'm curious as to why Real Frame Collector perceives that. Would like to see a couple of examples there. But yeah, it's certainly the case that we're not sort of like a tier one outlet, so to speak. So, you know, often we need to chase code. Often we buy games, right? And there's been many, many times where we've done that. So a tricky one in some respects. I mean, I was just thinking back to the recent AMD CPU reviews where outlets thought they were being blacklisted because AMD didn't send them a CPU. And I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, based on similar conditions, I think we've probably been blacklisted by absolutely everybody at some point. But except it's not really a blacklist. It's just, you know, either we fell off the radar for some reason, they didn't want us to review it. That's, you know, that's something that happens. There's all manner of different reasons as to why you might not receive something. It's a bit annoying when it happens, but ultimately, you know, we don't go in thinking that we're entitled to review code or devices. Whenever there's a new device or a console coming out, I always put pre-orders in because I don't 100% expect, Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo to just give us hardware just because of who we are. Oliver, what do you make of all of this?
Yeah, I would say code availability is the biggest impediment. Not necessarily that we never get code, but that it comes late, like with 007, or has different kinds of restrictions, or whatever the case may be. A little bit annoying there. For sure getting code late. I mean, I understand the reasoning there when it comes to us in particular, but like other outlets are also commenting on the technical performance of games in their pre-release state. I will say my experience is that it's actually quite rare that a day one patch fixes the majority of issues in a game or that it
really rare.
Even substantially improves the performance of a game in many cases. So yeah, I think that's it's a bit of a hopium thing, expecting that to fix all the problems in your software. In terms of like weird restrictions, I don't know if we want to get into this, but I think it did reflect in our content a little bit. The pacing, timing, presentation of our Resident Evil 9 content, I think, John, was very much affected by review embargoes in that one.
Oh, cool.
Where things were changing all the time on that, and we had to kind of pace things out, and certain things were restricted at certain times, and there were things that were added to the restrictions, and it was a bit of a messy situation. But
yeah, I think it was a one-off, though, right?
Yeah.
It was annoying, but what can you do? I mean, whatever. We got through it.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on to our next question. This one comes from Yogi. How do you think Microsoft will handle the Series S when Project Helix launches? Cross-gen releases have been common throughout this generation, so I expect many early Project Helix games to also release on Xbox Series consoles. He's saying many, I think everyone. Do you think Microsoft will continue requiring Series S support for those games, or will developers be allowed to release titles that run on Series X but not Series S? John?
Fundamentally, I mean, Xbox Series S and X will remain its own unique platform, right? That developers will have to either choose to target or not. Project Helix, from what we know, is more of a PC-based product, right? In that it's like designed to run essentially Windows and whatever other stuff that they're doing. But like, it's a separate platform. So like, I assume that if a game is just going to launch on Series X as well, then they'll just continue to release on Series S by any means possible. I mean, I'm amazed at how much stuff developers have managed to ship on the Switch 1, often inadvisably, I would say, as the quality of those conversions can sometimes be questionable, to say the least. I don't think Series S is going to reach that level necessarily, but I mean, it could, but I mean, I guess that's really it. Like, if developers are going to target older Xbox hardware, Series S will be a part of that. If not, then, you know, whatever.
Oliver, if we look at precedent, you know, Xbox One X could have persisted for much longer, except it had the kind of ball and chain of Xbox One S to contend with as well. And basically the response from developers was to say, actually, well, let's just cut back on that and just either put out a very poor version, which had implications for the One X version, or just skip it altogether and just ship on PS4, as we saw with games like Resident Evil 4 from Capcom, etc. Right. Do you think, I don't think there will be a case where they will ship on Series X but not S, but, you know, what do you think?
Even if it was allowed as a matter of platform policy, I'm not sure they would do it, because as far as we know, you know, Series S and Series X, they've sold a comparable number of units. I think maybe Series S is even a bit higher than Series X in terms of the sales, though we have no firm numbers from Microsoft. Of course, it's all from external third-party estimates and things like that. I would just expect that, hey, if you're really thinking Series S is going to get in the way of your Xbox Series release, then just don't ship on Xbox Series. And I don't think the market's going to punish you too much for that, because there are only so many Xbox Series units out there. And in a couple of years, few years, who knows, maybe there isn't that much of an appeal to it. And maybe, like you said, just like the PS4 situation has been for the past few years, lots of games released on PS4 still. A lot of those games don't release on Xbox One still, because the Xbox One audience is not there and the console's a bit weaker, and maybe you don't want to target it. So I'd expect Xbox Series support to just end a bit sooner than you'd think, in part because of Helix, in part because of the next generation of consoles, but also in part just because it never really caught fire. And if you have to deal with Series S and you're thinking that's going to be a huge issue for you, then don't do it. Now, there are plenty of examples of games that don't work that well in Series S. Of course, we've seen some recent examples like 007 First Light that work pretty well in it. So people are still getting some good experiences out of Series S. But it would be just an untruth to say that it hasn't been a problem for a lot of developers, right, to ship on a console, especially with that limited amount of RAM available, right, and that limited GPU. It's not an easy time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Series X and S kind of inextricably linked, and you can't really develop for one and not the other. I don't think that's going to change, but I don't know. Maybe there'll be some sort of end of line update for Series X that basically allows you to transition it into some sort of PC-like device. That would be interesting, and then, you know, it would be a PC. Who knows? Let's move on. The Adam asks, "Guten Tag, friends. Isn't the current market situation actually a blessing in disguise for gamers? Won't publishers be forced now more than ever to optimize their games better? I can imagine that Epic will also focus more on this with Unreal Engine 6. Better performance and stability for quote-unquote weak systems that lack RAM power and fancy NVIDIA wizardry. The performance gains and efficiencies of PCs and consoles will stagnate if this mutating AI bubble doesn't burst. Thank you for your hard work and good luck in the DF mines." That last comment, I'm not quite sure what a DF mine is, but regardless. John, what do you make of it about this? I mean, my take on this is that just fundamentally, the approach to multi-platform development now is to make your games run on as many systems as possible. And a factor of that is basically that you do have to kind of like optimize your games better, for better or worse, right?
Yeah, I'm a little confused at what he's... we've talked about this recently, but I feel like games in general, this generation, have been running better on average than the last two generations by far. Like, it's not even close. Like, there's definitely issues, and we did sacrifice image quality in a big way in a lot of games. That is absolutely true, but the performance itself is very, very good. And maybe we will see some, you know, further improvements to this as we approach the end of the generation. Traditionally, though, as generations go on, you start to see performance drop a little bit, but we haven't actually seen that yet, so I'm still confident it'll be fine. And I think it's probably okay to sort of float around at this level of hardware for a while and just wait out what was happening. I mean, these big companies don't seem that interested in making hardware for games any longer. So I guess it is, it's less of a blessing for us and more of a blessing for the development studios, right? Because games are taking so long to make, it would be better if they can just focus on known quantities, known hardware targets, and build towards that existing audience. And there is a big existing audience for all the machines out there right now. So, yeah. Mm.
I don't know, though. You know, if you think about it, we're 5 years, 5.5 years into this console mm-hmm. generation. So the equivalent time in the last generation would have been, what, 2018?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I still didn't feel like, you know, in 2018 we were running out of juice, so to speak,
no.
from the last generation consoles. I don't know. I still think it is the case, though, that just the reality of game development is that, you know, get your games on as many systems as possible, and you need to be able to scale in order to do that. And therefore, you know, quote unquote, optimization does play a part in that. What do you think, Oliver?
Well, I think the fact that we have the enhanced consoles last generation and this generation really helps extend them, at least in the eyes of the enthusiast, because we see these games. They're still like targeting 4K. They're doing 60 FPS on PlayStation 5 Pro. They look good. PSVR 2 is doing magic. I think that probably does make you a little bit less incentivized to get the new hardware. But in general, I mean, I think it's... I mean, it could be good for older games. I would just expect that what we're going to see is just an extremely long cross-gen period as a result, especially of this. But just in general, I mean, if we were expecting a long cross-gen before, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see like commercial PS6 software, PS5 software rather, into like the mid-2030s at this point. Like, I just think people have that hardware forever. And, you know, but that could be fine. I mean, games are more scalable than ever. And I expect, especially as you pile ray tracing on, ray tracing can make a game's visuals very scalable, especially as the vendors and various companies, I'm sure, develop more machine learning technologies that can be deployed in games, hopefully fairly easily without too much work, and improve visuals. That could also help greatly, I think. But I would actually be a little bit less worried about PS5 being the floor, because I think PS5, still perfectly respectable hardware, still has a pretty modern CPU, great storage system, still a great storage system, right? The GPU is perfectly fast in Raster, a little pokey in RT, but that's just the nature of the AMD RDNA 2-based hardware, right? I'd be more worried about, like, Switch 2 becoming the floor. If Switch 2 really catches fire as it has been, you know, having games needing to scale to, like, Switch 2, Series S, more of a concern maybe than PS5 and Series X, I would expect. That could be a problem. But yeah, in general, I would just expect, like, yeah, super, super long cross-gen. If the new consoles come out and they're super expensive, that's going to really put a damper on things. But luckily for us, kind of like John said earlier, you know, there are like 90-odd million PS5s out there. People have PS5s. pretty much everyone who wants a PS5 has gotten one. So that bodes... I think it doesn't bode that badly for the state of commercial software sales, but it does maybe pose some questions for, like, how do we develop games across two or three generations fundamentally of hardware, going from like Switch 2 to high-end PC, right? That's a bit more of a challenge, but I kind of think developers will get there. At least the high-end developers have been doing a good job of getting there, like the IO Interactives of the world, I think.
Okay, John, any final thoughts there?
Yeah, so recently I've been revisiting some games that are in the 10-year-old range, right? We talked about Uncharted 4 recently. I have a video in the works that I'm going to begin working on Batman Arkham Knight. And the big thing that sticks out to me here is that these games are games that, yes, they leverage hardware to pull off some beautiful visuals, but it isn't just about the hardware. There's very specific things that these games do to choices the developers have made. Like, you look at Batman, like, the FX pipeline in that is absolutely nuts. And there's just a lot of stuff with camera work and very specific selective materials and what they choose to focus on. Mm-hmm. Like tricks, essentially, that allow it to look really, really good. And this is the stuff that matters the most. Like, I don't think pushing hardware as hard as possible is always the answer. I think it's cool to be able to simulate things more accurately, but I think there's also more room for developers to grow their techniques beyond just, you know, leveraging more computationally expensive options. And I would like to see a return to that if we stick around in this generation longer, because I do think there's still a lot of room to grow. And the reason people perceive that some of these older games are still like contemporary or beyond a lot of modern stuff, it really is just like the pure artistry, the the work that these developers did, irrespective of the hardware platform, that makes them mm-hmm. shine. And I think that's really, really important to consider.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay. Well, that was the final question, therefore the end of the show. So please do like, subscribe, share if you enjoyed it. Ring bells for that kind of thing, instant notifications and whatnot. DF supporter program, patreon.com/digitalfoundry. Join us, join our amazing community. High quality video downloads of everything we do. Ad-free access to our website. Ad-free videos, indeed. Lots of great stuff going on there. So please do check that out. But that's all from us on this one. I guess we'll see you very soon on DF Direct Weekly. And obviously, there's going to be a lot of summer game shows happening, and festivals and fests, so we'll be covering that as well. But that's all from us on this one. Thanks for watching and supporting Digital Foundry, and we'll see you real soon.